Hi, I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have found a distinct perspective on time.
Spencer, this week you have on Uzodinma Aiwala, the CEO of Africa Center, who most recently published the book Speak No Evil. But I guess what most people know him for is his first book, Beasts of No Nation, which was turned into a Netflix film starring Idris Elba. What'd you guys talk about?
Well, here's someone who made some extraordinary choices with his time. He had a best-selling novel at 23, and instead of immediately going and writing his next book, he went to medical school. We had a fascinating conversation. We got into his writing, his experience of researching and reporting on HIV/AIDS, the result of which was a book called Our Kind of People, and now his leadership running the Africa Center.
Amazing. Let's get into it. Here's Spencer with Uzo Aiwala.
Uzo, welcome. I'm glad to have you here today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start the conversation going back 15 years ago to 2004, and you're graduating Harvard, and you have this book come out a year later at the age of 23, a book, right. Beasts of No Nation. It's the story of Agu, a child soldier who fights in a civil war of an unnamed West African country. You get huge acclaim. Glowing reviews. Salman Rushdie blurbs the book. It's a lot to go through at age 23.
Right.
By age 25, just a couple years later, you're named one of Granta's best young American novelists.
Right.
I find this fascinating, though, that like in the rush of all of this, you decide to go study medicine.
Sure.
Tell me about that. What was this sort of little detour that you took to medical school?
I mean, it's funny because it feels like, 15 years is a long time ago. And you know that thing where you don't necessarily feel like you've aged, but time has passed kind of situation. I was pre-med in college. And so I had always thought that I was going to study medicine. The thing is, like, I think I was pre-med because I didn't know what else people did. You know, my father's a doctor. I'm a Nigerian, like the kid of Nigerian immigrants. And, you know, there's this idea that there are certain professions that people do. There are things that you're a doctor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the immigrant kind of story situation. And, you know, like functional professions that I could see. So I think I'd always been on that track. But the truth was, I was a terrible science student. And not that science and medicine necessarily have all that much to do with each other. And we can talk about that. But like, you know, the screening process is, you know, you get really good grades and as a pre-med student, then you go on to some really fabulous medical school, and then you become some kind of surgeon, and then your life is set. And after Beasts of No Nation was published, the whole world in a way was just shifted. Like perspectives mm-hmm. opened, because not only did I get a taste of something that I'd always dreamed of, which was being able to publish, but also, you know, you get to see a whole world of possibilities of people in the arts, because being published and getting some attention for it just opens up doors to the whole artistic world. And that was just a thing. And so I think I went through a lot of turmoil and confusion, but ultimately, you know, the Nigerianness wins out in a lot of situations. And there are a couple of things. One is I was trying to decide, how do you really have an impact in the world? And as much as I love writing, the thing with writing is like, you don't necessarily see the immediacy of your impact. And back then it was also much harder because you didn't have any of the social media tools in the same way that you have them now,
right,
where you can literally get direct feedback. So with the book I most recently published, Speak No Evil, you know, I'm able to see people will just reach out to me, and I'm not that public on Instagram, but people will find and like email and say this book, that book. So you can see the impact it has on a one-to-one level. But with writing, it's kind of like you don't have that. You're not sure. Mm-hmm. With medicine, you definitely can, you know, you walk into a room, like somebody is not feeling well, you can provide instant relief. And then for me, even more, it's like when you're thinking about macro level health issues, my family's from Nigeria. I was born here, but my family's from Nigeria. And I spent a lot of time when we were growing up there. I could see my dad, for example, go back and run a free clinic in the village that we're from. And you would just see people come in, like lines of people. I'm talking about, he would start at 6 a.m. in the morning and wouldn't finish until midnight. And this was vacation, you know. So I could see directly what studying medicine could do in terms of this inner mission or desire to help people.
Yeah, it's hard to see your readers, right?
Right, exactly. And the thing is that, like, medicine isn't, it's not quite that. So, you know, I got to med school and I mean, there's a lot that happened during that time, and I'm happy that I went. But, like, I think I also understood that it wasn't the way that I wanted to have an impact. And that actually, you know, I've been blessed with a certain amount of ability when it comes to writing and using words to be able to impact people.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think there was, it's always intention inside me. I think those years of life, especially in the lead up to medical school, I didn't want to go. I'll be honest with you. I deferred for a year. I applied to medical school hoping that I would get rejected, pretty certain that I would get rejected, you know, and then I'd just be able to say, listen, you know, like, mom, dad, I got rejected. It's done. It didn't happen that way.
Yeah. So in early 2006, about a year and a half after Harvard, you began working on health policy issues in sub-Saharan Africa. Yeah. It was the Millennium Villages Project.
Yeah.
Talk about that experience.
Yeah, so that was actually my, I could say, I guess, my first job out of, well, not quite my first job, but out of college. Jeff Sachs and I, you know, again, this is what writing does, happened to have the same book agents. And we were at an event, and I met him and was like wowed by what he was doing, and went up to him afterwards. And I was like, listen, I would really love to, you know, like, work on this project. And with you. And he was just starting at the time. He'd been at Columbia for a couple years. Mm-hmm. The Earth Institute was just starting. The Millennium Villages Project was picking up steam. He was a special advisor on the Millennium Development Goals. You know, and I was some, like, punk kid who was just like, yo, I want to do that. And, you know, to his credit, he was very kind. And he was like, okay, well, why don't you come and see me? So I came up to New York. I was in DC at the time. I was actually dating somebody here in New York. And that probably was also part of the motivation. I came up and had an hour-long chat with him. And he was like, listen, if you'd like to work with us, why don't you come up to New York and do so? And so that was how I got, you know, into this world of health policy as opposed to medicine as medicine. And, you know, it was fabulous. It was like, what an experience to have as a 23, 24-year-old where, you know, you are helping to compile a health policy document, the manual for this whole Millennium Villages project, to be sent off to Nigeria to go and work with people in the field who are trying to put together programs around access to healthcare, infectious diseases, all that sort of stuff. It's mind-boggling and mind-opening. And yeah, I'm pretty lucky to have gotten that glimpse from the beginning, because I think you also got to see, or I also got to see, both the positives of what a broad and intensely dynamic vision can do in terms of unsticking people's entrenched beliefs about how health policy should be done. But I also got to see the problems inherent in having health policy driven by folks from outside of an environment, you know? So right. A lot of that Western, this is what you should do, versus what's happening on the ground and the realities of trying to provide care for people in resource-strapped countries.
Yeah, and the sort of intricacies of that. I read your book, Our Kind of People, which came out in 2012. A really incredible project. It took five years.
Yeah.
And talk about that process of going through the writing of this book, because the way you write it, I like that you kind of insert yourself into it in a way that makes the reader realize that you also were sort of unfolding these ideas happening in your head.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Our Kind of People, again, I think all books are kind of insane experiences. I mean, the idea that you're going to sit down and, like, I'm going to tell this story. I mean, I think it's why writers are, for the most part, kind of crazy individuals. You know, side note, I'm reading Robert Caro's LBJ biography series, and I'm just like, it's so full. I'm like, this man is insane. The amount of time necessary to get these details I could only hope to write a book like that. And I think that was part of this, the Our Kind of People. So I spent 5 years going back and forth to Nigeria, interviewing people about HIV. And so when I say that, I mean that I wanted to understand not what the health policy people were saying, although there was some of that, you know, not what government officials were saying, although there was some of that, but really, what are the narratives that people spin about HIV locally? The best example is I was in a nightclub in Lagos once, and I just remember overhearing conversation between two men where one man was asking his friend, he's like, so, you know, if the man has HIV and the wife has HIV, the man has HIV, but the wife doesn't have HIV, does that not mean the baby will get HIV because, you know, it's hereditary, it's passed on the way? So, like, you know, these ideas of how people are thinking about this disease based off of bits of information they've gotten, local knowledge, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what fascinated me, because in a lot of ways, your response to HIV isn't necessarily what's concocted in some, you know, like, conference room. Like, you can do that, but in reality, like, how that plays out on the ground is going to be based off of the narratives that people have of themselves as sexual beings, as, you know, in their own relationships, in relation to their government, traditional, cultural, religious. All of those things impact the way that we talk about health, that we talk about disease. More importantly, that we talk about a disease that is so related to something that is both absolutely necessary, wanted, and at the same time taboo, and that's sex. And that was what was fascinating to me in the exploration. So I got to travel all over Nigeria. And, you know, again, it was also for me a way of exploring a country that, you know, I grew up going to every summer, but that I didn't live in until after I graduated from medical school. So this was during, before I started medical school and during it, like, I would go to Nigeria and then I would just travel to random areas and be exposed to parts of the country that I had never seen before. And, you know, my family's from southeastern Nigeria, but it's a different country from northern Nigeria. It's a different country from western Nigeria. And that, like, really understanding what Nigeria was, how different it is, and then also falling in love with these different parts of Nigeria was just an amazing experience to have.
Yeah, I loved a few lines you had in the book that kind of show the diversity of place, not just Nigeria, but Africa as a continent. And one of them was, you write, HIV AIDS is part of the human experience, part of our cultural experience. AIDS is everywhere. And later in the book, you add, it is a major cultural event of the modern era that has reshaped the relationships that individuals, countries, and even whole continents have with one another.
I mean,
you begin to think about this on such a deeper level when you read your book. And not surprisingly, I saw that Bono had blurbed it on the back, somebody who obviously has spent a lot of time thinking about these issues.
Right.
I felt so, as a Westerner, someone living in New York and not deeply understanding the intricacies of both HIV AIDS and also certain cultural things having to do with Africa, it was amazing to me to read your book, which is, you know, relatively slim. It's 200 pages, but has so much sort of depth in it and layers that make you realize you can't understand this thing as something that's super simple.
Right.
You can't oversimplify it and you can't sensationalize it.
Right.
In the context of thinking about your work as a writer, what I thought was really interesting too was how you thought about linguistics and language and these sort of ideas of how it's mediated.
Mm.
And you were critical in the book in a few different places. One of the Christiane Amanpour from CNN and the New York Times, you pointed out, is guilty of it.
Right.
The New Yorker has also. I found it interesting that you were able to kind of weave this really personal narrative while also exposing these larger cultural and social forces happening around our understanding in the West of Africa, as well as this virus in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting place to sit where I am, being firmly ensconced in both places. The point you make about the simplicity of narratives that people have had about the continent is something that, you know, I see very much now and that I saw then, which is frustrating because you know a place. It's like if somebody tried to distill New York into like a sentence, like a tagline, New Yorkers would be like, what are you talking about? Forget about it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not going to fly. And so New York is so many things. It's the skyscrapers. It's the grittiness. It's the, you know, immigrant communities. It's the Wall Street bankers. It's the artists, all of which are in tension with each other. You know, there's a dynamism to this city. And the same is true about a country like Nigeria, about a city like Lagos, about the village that my family is from. And I think when you understand that, your understanding of how something as culturally important and seismic as HIV AIDS will necessarily have to change. And so it's both, I think, pointing to a couple of things, that it's a clinical disease is never just, it's never just a clinical thing. Mm-hmm. It is always interpreted and reinterpreted and has so much to do with the way that culture is shaped, with the way that language is used to describe things. And that's so important in how we talk about the disease, and then how we talk about the people who are impacted by the disease. I
mean, one part in the book, you point out the phrase "dropping like flies."
Right,
my heart sank. I mean,
yeah.
And you asked, "Is this how Africans are considered as insects, animals, not human?" I felt so kind of gross, almost as a Western person, thinking that this is how a lot of people here think.
Yeah. I mean, I feel kind of gross when I think about it too, because, you know, and it's funny, we don't actually really think about the terms that we use. And some of these things, it's not to get too deep into it, but some of these things are just turns of phrase, but they all have origin and they all also have implications when you use them to describe people. And the more you use things, the more you use things like collateral damage, the more you use, you know, all these phrases that we've developed to sanitize or to help shorthand things, the more you lose sight of the people behind it. And that's not to be persnickety about everything, right? Because then no one would speak. But I think it is interesting, and you see it, you know, that the book came out in 2012 and I had started thinking about it and writing in 2006. Now the dialogue about how we refer to things has come so far now that we're in 2019, so that people are a lot more conscious, and it's hard to be a lot more conscious about the phrasing that you use. It's hard to be careful about the words that you use. And sometimes you just want to speak, but speech is power. You know, and that's something that I think became very clear to me, especially in that health policy realm, where you saw who was allowed to speak and the terms that they used and who didn't get to speak and how that impacted the way that they lived.
Mm. And the silence, that was one of the other things, is this is a silent virus.
Right.
And that's its power, that in what is not said.
Right.
About it.
Right. It's a silent virus in the way that it operates, and it's a silent virus in the way that societies don't want to speak about it. You know, again, that idea of speech is power. Speech gives you power over this thing. It gives you power to deal with this thing. And the less you speak about it, the more likely it is to control you, whether you are an individual or you are a society. And so I think it's really interesting to see how many campaigns to deal with the virus talk about speaking up or empowering people or giving people the space to be able to speak about what they are going through. And not just the again, the clinical aspects of the disease, but what it means to be physically isolated from people because you have a disease. That in and of itself is a silencing. And that's a silencing that societies need to come to terms with, because that is what allows for not just the silencing, but the fear of being isolated leads to a silence that leads to further issues with the spread of HIV/AIDS. And so I think in Nigeria, which is where the book, you know, takes place, but all across the continent, and also here in societies that have had HIV present, dealing with that silence and that idea of isolation and being ostracized was a huge part of being able to tackle how do you actually deal with with HIV itself.
Mm. And I think one of the things that I thought in your book you did with great care, which must have been really difficult, was to be open and honest about the discomfort you felt around a lot of the people you interacted with. On being on the AIDS care team at Columbia, you described that you would often find it hard to observe the physical deterioration of some of the patients, and that you had this desire to recoil or to protect yourself, and in particular sort of pointing out how thin this line is between what your role and responsibility was there as a professional, but also fear.
Yeah, and I think fear is, for me as a writer, it was important to acknowledge fear. And to acknowledge that in this exploration, I was not coming from any position of authority, because in large part, I don't know that people are. And I think that anybody who claims to come from a position of absolute authority, that's how we got to some of the nonsense around Africans and HIV/AIDS, or just initially in the States, the way that people approach the disease. But, you know, I think for me, like those emotions, those human emotions, and being very honest and digging deep in about what is it you're really feeling, was really important to me as a writer to be able to access the stories that I wanted to, because it is a real part of life. It is a real part of even treatment. And I think that was one of the things that made being a practicing physician hard for me. Like, you know, I was in med school at the time, but I was constantly asking about, like, not just what is the patient feeling, but like, what are we feeling as care providers? Right. And, you know, like, you don't really have time for that on the horse.
Yeah. And there's one kind of harrowing scene in the book where you're about to board a flight or you've just boarded a flight and you get a text or an email telling you that one of the subjects that you had met had just died of the disease. And right. I'm just going to read the portion from the book because I had to pause after it. It was so powerful. I sat there staring out the window at the large body of the plane I was about to board, stunned. A living, breathing someone who was once here was now not. The connection that we had started to form suddenly cut short.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone could probably read that and not pause.
Yeah. No, and I remember that moment, and it actually comes from some of the work or the shadowing I did of people in northern Nigeria, in a particular state, in Niger state. There was a whole community of people living with HIV and AIDS that was like extremely strong and really supportive. And I remember getting that call from this activist named Samaila Garba, who was telling me, just updating me on some of the people that I had met during that time. And yeah, I mean, it does, you have to stop because you just live your life, right? You just keep going. You're like, I'm writing a book. That's what I'm doing. I'm trying. And then you're like, oh, wait, no, take it a step back, slow it down. Like, this is life, and this is what life is. It is death. Death is part of our existence. It's part of life. It's also the pain and suffering that comes after it, like for the people who are left behind, and also in the lead up to it. And that's, again, what the book was trying to get at, that all of these things are what make our lives complicated and what make this disease both fascinating and also devastating.
Mm. Toward the end of the book, you really stress the importance of both human connection and conversation.
Right.
Talking about human connection, of course, there's the ostracization that happens when somebody comes out as being HIV positive. What power ultimately do you think, upon after writing this book and now having several years to reflect on it, do you think human connection has over helping alleviate or shift perceptions of this disease?
Oh, I mean, I think it's all powerful. I think that idea of reaching out, that the idea of physical connection or emotional connection, this idea of I see you, is so important. And I think, you know, and the realization that you are seen is also, I mean, incredible. And so, you know, if you talk with someone like Samaila Garba, that mm-hmm. activist, the former police officer in northern Nigeria, that was what he was about when he came out, that to say that I have HIV AIDS. I mean, it was all about saying, look at me, I'm human, just like you. And then reaching out and providing support to people who also had HIV AIDS. But also, you know, like, encouraging people to reach across that divide. And those divides, you know, like, are the ones that we erect. You know, they're the very real ones, like, as I talk about, created by fear. But that can also be, you can get beyond that. And it's getting beyond that, showing people that you have the ability to get beyond it, whether it's you're from the United States and you can't really understand this environment, but you try. Whether it's, you know, you're from Nigeria and you have never, you know, seen or met anybody with HIV AIDS and it comes to you, but you try. I think that act of reaching out and reaching across is what has transformed the trajectory of the disease. I can't stress that enough, because for all of the medication and science, which is absolutely important, it is a very human thing to be able to say to somebody, I see you and I want to help you, or here I am, like, and let's do this together. And I think that's what I was trying to get at.
If you were to add a appendix chapter to the book now, what type of story do you think you would find or have from the last 7 years?
I mean, I think there's a lot over the last 7 years that one could speak about, from the fact that treatment has improved so much in terms of what people need to do to get treated. So just a pill, you know, and that changes so many things. Your life expectancy goes virtually back to normal if you're consistent with medication. I think that's one. Two, that, you know, if you've got treatment in that form, that it really is a cash game, and that we've moved away from a lot of the stuff that was putting blame on people who had contracted HIV, saying like, oh, it's your promiscuous sexual habits, to like, look, that's not our business. Our business is, can we get you treatment? And that changes so much, you know, that changes the whole game. So I think there would be a lot around that. And then I think there would be a lot around have we lost sight about how powerful a cultural shaper this epidemic actually was in light of so many other challenges that we now see? You know, and this is the thing about a lot of these big global issues. At a time when you now have climate change that everyone's focused on, you've got this sort of like return of populism, you know, like, are you losing sight of how important and impactful this actually is? And is that going to create issues in the long run? Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, these are all the things that would have to go into any kind of addendum or appendix that comes on a book like this.
Right. I want to circle back now to your first book, Beasts of No Nation, which in more recent years, people probably recognize as a Netflix film starring Idris Elba.
Yeah.
And you elaborated a little bit on it, that this the writing and publishing of this book opened up doors to certain cultural realms that
right.
you just hadn't interacted with before. Over the past 15 years, what would you say, in addition to this Netflix film, has been the sort of reception, and how has this book sort of influenced your path forward, your life?
Yeah, I mean, I, to this day, feel so lucky for the experience of Beasts of No Nation, right down to the former child soldier who I happened to have a conversation with that prompted me to write the initial short story.
When you were running the...
When I was running the African Students Association at Harvard, yeah, I spoke with a child soldier, a former child soldier from Uganda. And it was a brief conversation. She had given her talk, but our interaction was very brief. But that just, it hit something in me. So from that to being able to work with someone like Jamaica Kincaid, which, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, I mean, I shouldn't say this because, you know, it'd probably make my parents not happy. But like, I don't know that my time at Harvard was worthwhile until having that experience with her. Mm. Like that year, working on that this book with her literally transformed my life. You know, so there's that. And then to like having it set me on a path to do something that is so important to me, which is writing. Mm. Now, you know, when we come to the, I mean, and just to go back to this idea of writing, I mean, like to be able to write out the gate, sort of live your wildest dreams as a writer. I mean, like, what is it to go and sit down with Salman Rushdie and like have a conversation where he's like, I like your book. I'm like, wait. You know,
or simply having someone like Jamaica Kincaid who loved your writing so much, right. She introduced you to her agent.
So, right, her agents. Who, I mean, you know, when I think about it now, it's 2019. I mean, 15 years I've been with my agents who she introduced me to. That's like that's longer than a lot of marriages. You know, like, you know, like all of that has been so wonderful. You then get to this idea of the film and how many books get optioned, how many books get made into films. To have someone like Cary Fukunaga, who is a super intense, masterful storyteller, have this be part of his own career growth and trajectory is an amazing thing. Because, you know, when we started, he had just produced his first film. This was 2007, 2008, Sinombre. And, you know, Beasts of the Nation had come out a couple years before. But, you know, so we started at like, you know, you're starting at the beginning and like being able to like really trust that somebody was going to treat this project with and treat the adaptation of this with all the care in the world. And to see that happen, to see that, you know, 10 years after it's published, really, it transformed into a totally different project. It's just an amazing experience. And I'm very grateful to him and to the producers and all those folks for really believing in it over that period of time. A lot of people have just been like, you know what?
Yeah.
Screw this. Like, I got other things I want to do. But like, he really, really wanted to make this particular film.
And you, I imagine, must have had quite a strong connection with Cary to feel like,
yeah,
that he could shepherd this project forward.
Yeah, I remember watching Sinombre, and it was at the end when I just sat kind of in stunned silence, and I was like, this man can make some films. And like, what do I know? I'm not a filmmaker. I just know I was super moved by his storytelling. Yeah, to watch him work on that film from the first adaptation through to actually shooting. And I, you know, some of the conversations that really made me feel very good about his work is that he was like, look, you know, people are going to tell me that I should shoot this in Kenya or South Africa because there's more infrastructure. He's like, no, this film feels like a West African film. I need to shoot it in West Africa. And, you know, if it's hard, it's hard. you know, and that was like, that was something that he pushed for, that we talked about, and that I have so much admiration for, you know, the casting of the kids in that film. I mean, you could have gone with other people, but like the idea that, no, we're going to make this as close to the imagined realm that we can. I think that that speaks to a remarkable level of insight and perseverance and dedication to storytelling. Mm. Now, you know, obviously there's the rollout afterwards, and that's, you know, having it be Netflix's first kind of feature experience. If not for that, you know, I don't know that the film would have been seen by as many people, right? You know, so how many millions of people have seen it? And I know it's in the millions because Netflix keeps those numbers or whatever. That's an amazing experience. Like, and, you know, you say Beasts of No Nation and people know the film, and then they go and watch the book, they go and read the book, you know, but having had that be a part of this book's life and trajectory, I think is a really amazing thing. Mm. Certainly, it feels very amazing for me. And I really hope that it also does shed light on, you know, the way that stories can humanize and illuminate people in certain situations, which was the original point of writing the book itself.
And I think also, you know, not only offering access to people in Africa to be able to watch this film, but to offer to the West a deeper understanding of the complexities, contradictions, challenges that a country has faced, a nation has faced, and a nation currently still faces.
Right. Right. And that you say complexities, and I think that's what it is. Again, like in a similar vein to our kind of people, this idea of people are complicated. Let's explore the complicated nature of what it means to exist as a human, whether you're talking about a little boy who's turned into a child soldier, or you're talking about an adult who has HIV AIDS, or you're talking about, you know, whatever. It's the idea that you only do someone justice when you try. And I'm not saying we always succeed, but when you try to depict the multi-dimensional nature of a person's personality. And that's what writing for me is about. That's what character development is about. And that translated from the book onto the screen, and that has translated into the way that people think about certain events that have happened in our lifetimes, I think is a dream come true.
Yeah. And how do you feel about this in the context also of the past few years, where more Black actors, more African-American actors, directors, costume designers,
right,
are getting long overdue recognition, or even a blockbuster like Black Panther? That's stemming out of this culture that this film also came out of.
I think it's really amazing and remarkable. I mean, I watched a little bit of the Oscars. To see Black Panther win in categories for like costume design, to see it win, like, I think that speaks to a couple of things. One is that people are waking up and recognizing that there is a desire to depict Blackness, which is traditionally kind of like a monolithic thing within, again, all of its different dimensions and whatnot, that it's not just people screaming out into the world like, we are here. It's the world also realizing that, like, look, these people are here and they are people, right? And people doesn't just mean, oh, you're talking about a rapper or a basketball player. It's like, they're Black people who sit down and do costume design and who geek out to saying, like, how can I depict this thing as incredibly as I possibly can, that a Black actor, Black director, Black, you know, like a whole Black cast can create a $1 billion film where everyone's like, oh, that's just a niche market, forgetting that most of popular culture, the billions upon trillions of dollars that are popular culture, are actually what? Black culture, just turned or adapted for people who don't want to believe that's the case. In a way, it's making obvious something that Black people have always known, which is that we are precious. I mean, and that's both in a real sort of like a real human sense and also in a commodity sense, which, I mean, if Black people weren't precious, why were people trading us all over the place, right? So I think these are things that it's really kind of weird to have a price tag, especially in the context of talking about Black bodies, like to say like, oh, look, all of these Black bodies grossed, you know, about $2 billion on the big screen. Like, that feels weird. And, you know, it's one of those weird things. It's like both disgusting and also in some crazy
liberating
way, a validation. Like, and I think you have to be very, very careful about how you speak about it. But at the same time, I think we also need to get up and own the fact that so much of what is popular in the world, Black people drive. It's just that now people are recognizing, oh, wait, yeah, that's what Black people do.
Right. I'm remembering back to a couple years ago when the it's a mouthful to say this, but National African American Museum of History and Culture in Washington, D.C. opened.
Yeah.
And visiting that space, not only was I, as a white man, in the minority in this building, which was also such an amazing experience, but to see the breadth of culture on display and understand the massive void that that building and its contents were filling and that had never had a home was really profound.
Yeah, I mean, you know, D.C. is my city. That's where I grew up. I mean, I think there's just so many things about that museum. One, the fact that if you look at all the buildings around it, they're all white.
The colonnades.
Exactly. Like, you know, sort of classical or like our American interpretation of classical architecture. You know, this obelisk that, I mean, I guess you could say is like an interpretation of Egyptian, like whatever, that is the Washington Monument. And then there's this building that is dark, right? And it's in its strange way, like also almost like an inverted version of the monument, but the brilliance behind that structure and its placement, wonderful. And then, like you said, stepping inside and being transported, you know, it's a lot to take. You need a lot of time to go through that museum.
At least 4 hours.
Man, like try days.
Yeah. Like, 4 days.
you need to go back and go back but I think that speaks to something about how you have to understand the role that Black people have played in the United States of America. This is not a month's worth of history, right? This is not a year's worth of history. This is something you have to keep coming back to all the time to really and truly understand the impact that Black people have made on the United States of America. There is no United States of America if there are no Black people, period. And that museum proves that point. And I think it's a national treasure. I mean, all the stuff inside it was national treasure before, but the collection of it makes it a profoundly important national treasure. You know, I think to have it in a city that is a Black city, or at least was a Black city, you know, Washington, D.C., that a lot of people didn't think about as a Black city, because, you know, all you see again is these white buildings of government and the predominantly white representation in government, forgetting that Washington, D.C. at one point in time was close to 80% Black, you know, and that has driven a lot of cultural life in the city. And that, because also these things like the relationship of the federal government to Blackness, that D.C. has had a very entrenched and profound middle class and upper middle class, because the federal government was essentially one of the only things that could guarantee somewhat equal treatment, you know. So that's how you develop and it builds. But I think that, like, the importance of these monumental forms to show the presence of Blackness is, it can't be understated. And it can't be understated because it's what everyone does. You know, it's like, why again are there, like, why are we talking about Confederate statues? Because people understand the importance of these symbols in terms of driving narratives. And there's a whole lot to talk about there, which we can do.
I do want to stay in Washington, D.C.
Sure.
And talk about your latest book, Speak No Evil, which has as the protagonist Niru, who's raised in that city by two parents of Nigerian descent, like you, a top student, track star at his high school, and he's bound for Harvard in the fall. Mm-hmm. So some similarities, right. I imagine. Were you a track star?
No, God,
okay.
No.
Okay, so and he has a secret that he's gay, which is a sin to his parents. Mm-hmm. How did you kind of conceive of this book? How did this book become your next one after writing the first two? And connected to that, why did you choose Washington, D.C. as sort of the place to...
I mean, a number of reasons. You know, this book wasn't not as all projects. I think when I started Beasts of the Nation, I very much wanted to write about child soldiers and knew that from the beginning. With Speak No Evil, it was a whole bunch of different books before it was this book. And the only thing that I know was core to this book was wanting to write about Washington, D.C., precisely because a lot of literature or film or television about the city really doesn't treat the city as a place where real people live. You know, it's Washington, like that is like politics and the high drama of that versus the fact that, like, you know, I grew up there and I know that, like, people got to go to school, people got to go to work, and that there are all these intense lives lived in this place. And so I really wanted to try and construct a city that I knew as a character in a way that, you know, you don't see it in very many books. And that's not to say that it isn't. There are a number of books in which, like, the city is very much a living thing. But I wanted to try and add my own flavor to that. Mm. Now, in terms of the characters, you know, I started thinking about, like, when you start thinking about the immigrant story, like, what does that look like in 20, I think I finished the book in, like, in 2017, 2018. What does that look like now? You know, there, these fault lines, there are some fault lines that you will continuously have. But what are the issues that, like, come up that are specific to the time that we're living in, that I'm living in, that really can illuminate what it means to have to make those global journeys? And I think one of the issues was around sexuality or sexual identification. And, you know, that's how Niru ends up being a gay character, because it's one of those things that, like, you can take parents, their parents have come over, they are, you know, trying to make it, they're successful in all these other ways, but there's certain things that they're not grasping. And there's certain things that they can't speak about across the lines of having had a kid that was born here that is socialized very differently from they were. And that doesn't mean that, you know, in any context that anyone is bad, it just means that there's a lot of communication that doesn't happen or that can't happen because people lack the words, the vocabulary to actually, or the emotional ability at that time. Like, you have to grow into that. And that growth can be very, very painful, and it may not happen. And I think that's what, for me, Speak No Evil is about, in terms of how do you write about something like this? And, you know, it's an imperfect book in some ways, but, like, it's my attempt to say, like, how do we tell this particular story or reimagine this story in this modern age? Mm.
So, separate from the book, what was your childhood in DC like? and I know you spent your summers going back to Nigeria.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that.
I mean, you know, my childhood in DC was pretty, like, that's the thing, it's like very normal. Like, it was just, you know, I was the kid of immigrants, like a very upper middle class kind of Washington, DC existence. My dad is a doctor, now retired. My mom worked for the World Bank for a while and then became Minister of Finance in Nigeria. That wasn't until we were in college. But, you know, I grew up in first in Northwest DC and then in the northern suburbs of DC, which were also very white environments, but in a very Nigerian household. So I didn't ever really feel, you know, I think you sense the frustration. And I think when you're really young, you don't necessarily have the words to put to what you see and what you're feeling in the way that people react to you as a Black person or an African person in this world. But at the same time, you know, like, my parents were excellent about making sure that we understood who we were and that we were supported and that they would always be there for us. You know, the best example is, like, going to a pretty much predominantly white Catholic primary school. And, you know, realizing that it was always me and my brothers who were kind of singled out for being too wild, and having parents that were just like, oh, hell no, 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 you're not going to do that to my kid. Or making sure that, having parents that would come in and make sure that no matter what happens, my kid is going to be in the honors classes, because otherwise you're just going to look at my kid and say, oh, they don't have the ability. No, that's not going to happen. And you need to have that in order to survive and thrive in those worlds. And I'm internally grateful to my parents for exactly that. But beyond that, it was just like being a kid, you know, playing basketball in the summers, like video games, all the stuff that kids, oh, not really video games, let me not lie. Like, I stopped at Nintendo 64. So, but all the things that you do just with this extra awareness of what it means to be different and how being different is both a drag in some ways, because as a high school kid, as a teenager, you just want everything to be easy. But knowing that the way that you're exposed to an understanding of your difference can provide you with a richness in your life beyond. And that's what I feel I have now is that, like, having somebody, you know, in communities that could help me, could help shape and help me understand what it meant to be me as a Black man, as a African immigrant, as a Nigerian, you know, and as just like a somewhat nerdy kid who couldn't really run track.
And as a kid, what was your Lagos? What was your Nigeria experience like?
Yeah, so that was also interesting and complicated. I think you go through phases. I think when you're really young, it's just a place where you get to run around and see grandma and granddad, or, you know, all your grandparents. And, like, it's all fun. And I remember when we were really young and being super fascinated by, like, my dad's parents have now passed, but I got to know them, like, you know, while we were growing up. And my mom's parents, thankfully, are still alive. But going to their different houses and just being able to run around these compounds, like, be in the village, go to the stream, that sort of thing. It's just a very, like, visceral, in touch with this space. But then as you get older and you begin to realize, you know, you're only here every so often and like things change while you're here, like you change. And then having a more complicated understanding of who you are, like realizing that when your mom is packing, like she's packing six suitcases and you're like, well, they're not that many of us. And it's like, oh, these gifts aren't for you. It's that, you know, we need to bring gifts back for everybody when we come. And so you're like, oh, okay, that's a realization. Realizing that your mom is also putting all the food that you guys, like I have three siblings. I have an older sister and two younger brothers. You know, my mom would pack like boxes of Frosted Flakes and like peanut butter and all those things that we couldn't get in Nigeria at the time, because she's like, you know, I want my kids to be comfortable. And realizing, oh, that sets me apart. You know, the conversations you have with your cousins as you as you become a high school student, you recognize your cousins have a totally different lived experience of what it means to be a high school student, like boarding student in Nigeria, than you do, and like all of that. So it gets more complicated the older you get. And the narratives that are given to you as kids by your parents or whoever, they don't work anymore. And there comes a point where you have to decide what kind of narrative are you going to construct for yourself. And I think that creates a lot of tension. And, you know, I would have conversations with my own dad. There's something like that replicated in the book where, you know, Niru talks to his father about the fact that he doesn't feel Nigerian. You know, and I remember having those conversations with my siblings, with my parents about like, well, what does it actually mean to be from this place? And then for me, being so fascinated by that question that after I graduated from college, I was there for a year and a half. And then after I finished medical school, like I couldn't wait to get back to Nigeria, because, you know, you answer this question in different ways depending on how you have matured as a person. And I think that will be a question that I will continuously have to come back to. So I moved back here from Lagos a year ago. I'd spent 6 years in Nigeria, a couple in Abuja, and then the rest in Lagos. And like, you know, coming to Lagos as a 29-year-old and being like, okay, I'm not, when I graduated from college, I was like living at we had a house in Abuja. I was living there. You know, you just graduate from college. It's a different thing to coming and saying, I'm going to start my own business. I'm going to see what it's like to be a professional. I'm going to like find my own apartment, do all of these things in this context. And like, how do I understand myself as a Nigerian now, as opposed to what was told to me when I was younger?
And that's when you were working on Africa Ventures magazine?
Yes, yeah, so that's when I was working on Ventures Africa, which is a publication my uncle and I founded. And that was both insane to think that you can start a magazine, and also like, well, why the hell not? To a certain extent, one has to recognize privilege. And, you know, I come from a real position of privilege in Nigeria, for sure. I mean, if your mother is the Minister of Finance, also already you're coming from the United States with that earning power of US dollars, it does mean it's a different society that you're living in. And it's hard explaining to somebody what it's like to fly into a place. Like, I've had friends come and be like, whoa, dude, like, I didn't know your life was like this. And you're like, I didn't know my life was like this until I got here. And that's like all the paraphernalia that can come with being sort of the top percentile in a country that is not necessarily my life here in the United States of America. So that has to be acknowledged, and that there's a lot that's been afforded to me because of that. But then, you know, on the flip side, it's also about like, how do you really take the time to immerse yourself in a place and like not be afraid to be of that place and make mistakes in your learning how to be in that place. And that was one of the things, that's one of the gifts that Nigeria gave to me. And I think a lot of people who, you know, the repats as people call us, who come back, you come back with like a real undeserved sense of like, I got this, you know, and Nigeria will just smack you in the face and ask you, who are you? And that is so important because it helps you, just helps you recalibrate the way that you think about yourself and how you relate to people of all types. Yeah.
This reminds me of the piece you wrote for The Guardian 3 years ago called I Dream of a Utopian Lagos.
Yeah.
and in it, you open it up by showing this place where you go to clear your head.
Yeah.
And there's some private land that somebody wealthy owns, and they're security guards are telling you, what are you doing here? Go away.
And
it's actually public land that you're on. I'm sure that must be a sort of surreal experience to be on public land, but feel.
Yeah, it's what happens in a society where maybe some of these, it's what happens in a fundamental libertarian society. Let's just put it that way. So, I mean, it's funny. We talk about it. I love Nigeria to death, but also for all the folks here who like want to live in a libertarian world, come and visit me, I can tell you, you won't like it that much. Because what happens is it's whoever is strongest is who wins, right? You know, so certain things, the things that we enjoy here, the fact that Central Park is here is an amazing thing. And yes, like we know that like certain villages and places were cleared to put it, but like there is, you know, with that very much in mind, like let's also talk about the fact that this is public property, that anyone, it doesn't, if you have no money, if you live on Fifth Avenue and you've got, you know, a gazillion dollars that you, more money than you can count, like you cannot own Central Park. You know, and for that reason, we all have access, and it creates an interesting sense of ownership over the city. The same is true for Prospect Park. Like these public spaces do create something, a sense of belonging and a sense of presence in a place that can be somewhat transient. And I think one of the biggest issues that I had with Lagos is that like it's such a beautiful city, and it's, you know, it's a city like New York, it's on the water, you know, it's a city of islands, all of that, but there isn't very much space that people feel like they own, that the public owns. Certainly private individuals can roll in and grab a, you know, like this is my jetty or whatever, and you're just like, I just want a space where I can feel like I'm amongst people and amongst the beauty of the natural surrounding. And I think that for me was one of the really tough things. You know, Lagos is a city that's constantly changing. And I think this is one of the things that's being addressed. Even over the last few years, you start to see the emergence of more public parks or green spaces because people realize that they want that. And what's interesting, I think, is if you go back, and this is like the sort of geeking out part of me, mm-hmm. if you go back and you take a look at the fact that like a lot of, for especially for a city like Lagos and for a lot of where we are, a lot of life happened in the streets, happened in public places. But just this idea of public and private ownership was maybe a little bit different versus you had the British come in and start creating these spaces, zones where you could go to do this, you couldn't go to do that, chopping up the way that people normally moved, which is an intent. It's not a byproduct. It's an intent of colonialism and colonial presence. And then you get to where we are in the modern day, where the society has to reconstitute itself and reimagine itself around some of this stuff that's been brought in. And that is, it's tragic, but it's also as much the story of Lagos as anything else. So, you know, how do we reimagine ourselves and reimagine civic space, public space, and what it means to build a society and a sense of community in a land that has been chopped up and parceled out and privatized? And it's also not unique to Lagos. I mean, like, they complain about it. I mean, you know, the innovations that the Brits brought to us are the ones that are now sort of cannibalizing themselves. Like this idea of London, a city where you have all of these private public spaces where like you can't actually be a citizen in them because HSBC technically owns it, you know, like that kind of thing. I find it fascinating, troubling, but also the thought that the city will learn to live around it as something that's really interesting and part of what it means to be a Nigerian today. Mm.
So you have all this rich experience that we've been discussing now, from the books to your experience in medicine and your deep understanding of these two worlds that you've kind of lived between your whole life. As the CEO of the Africa Center, what are your hopes there to sort of bring to bear? I know its primary focus is culture, policy, and business.
Yeah, the Africa Center, that's another kind of detour. You know, what is a doctor doing running a not-for-profit like museum on Fifth Avenue in New York City? I'm like, I wake up in the morning, I'm like, yeah, what are you doing? So the thing, just to give a little bit of history, I mean, yeah. I started at the Africa Center just under a year ago. You know, and for me, it was a number of things. I had been in Nigeria for about 6 years at that point in time. I just finished writing Speak No Evil as a novel. I'd been thinking about, you know, do I want to come back to the United States? Do I want to stay here? Kind of what's the next step? This opportunity came along to work at and run, lead the Africa Center as it kind of moved through this period of transition. And I was like, well, you know, why not? I mean, what I am about is storytelling. And what I think cultural institutions are about, just in a more physical, structural sense, should be about storytelling. I don't know the least about running a museum, but I figure if they're going to hire me, like, that's not really their concern. We're not building a museum. We're building something different. So I was like, all right, I'll come back to New York. It's cool. The Africa Center has been through a lot. It has a bit of a history. I mean, it started as the Museum for African Art. We acquired this space, this 70,000 square foot space on Fifth Avenue. And then, of course, the financial crisis hit. It became a bit difficult to finish the space. And it's been a long time. And I can say now that we have decided to phase the opening, and we have a space open with a wonderful cafe in it. You should come and eat, by the way, and an exhibition going on and more coming over the course of the year. But I think I would not have taken this job if it had been something that was more established. Like, what I really love is the art of its creating. You know, so whether you're sitting down to try and write a book, or whether you're saying, okay, we have this, you know, essentially blank canvas of an institution with an idea that what we really want to do is represent Africa to the world, to New York City, certainly, to our community in Harlem, and then to the wider world. What is the story you're going to tell, both of the museum, and what are the stories you're going to put inside this institution? That was what really fascinated me about the Africa Center. And so on paper, yeah, we focus on business, culture, and policy, but really the idea is about transforming narratives. It's really about how do you provide the wider public with new narratives about the continent. And if we can do that by having a fabulous installation by Victor Ekpok, this Nigerian American artist, or if we can do it by having an orchestra come and play in our space or film screenings, like, that's all part and parcel of projecting a new narrative for me. And as we build up the space, I hope we get to do a lot more of that. But yeah, I'm not going to lie, it's not a joke. Like, there's a lot of stuff about running a cultural institution, especially here in New York City. There's a huge learning curve. And like, over the last year, I would say that I've learned a lot.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's tested your leadership, because it's one thing to sit down and write a novel.
It's a totally different thing to work with a team of people, to work with people who have more expertise and more knowledge than you. I have managed a construction project in Nigeria. Working on a construction project in New York is a whole other thing. And there are people who, this is their life, you know? So like, being able to say, I have a vision, but also humble enough to know that like, this person really knows about what it is, like how you actually build a building. That's something that like you have to learn. And like, you know, I think working on a startup magazine in Nigeria, having that experience of coming back and being smacked in the face by what it means to operate something in Nigeria helps a lot, because you know when to be quiet. Like, you know when to just sit down and say, okay, let me just listen for a second. You know, having to work with a board, right? Obviously, like, the board is the major support for the institution, but there are also, you know, multiple voices, and people have different ideas of what they want to do. And so like, it's about how do you learn how to build consensus? You know, how do you learn how to take all these ideas into account, take someone's vision and make it a reality? And that, it's a learned skill. And yeah, I've been learning a lot in that.
I'm sure your experience of research, reporting, and writing about AIDS actually has really informed some of this work.
You know, funny enough, like, going to medical school, like, being able to sit down and really listen to someone, I think is super important. Being something of a reporter or a journalist, you know, having to sit down and like, really, what are they saying to me, but like, how are they saying what they're saying to me, I think is equally important. How does that then translate into the actions that I'm going to take? All of that has been extremely helpful. And, you know, in that sense, like, nothing is lost. I mean, you could say that I wasted 4 years in medical school because I don't practice, or you could say like that was an educational experience, even including the failures that I had in medical school were preparation for being able to deal with something as enormous a task as this. So, and I failed a lot in medical school.
I want to close with this sort of idea of storytelling, because it is the thing that's woven throughout all of your practice. And of course, oral storytelling goes very far back into, you know, African tradition. And in our kind of people, you talk about how Africans revel in the sound of our voices. How do you plan to do some of this reveling beyond the programming at the Africa Center? Like, what do you hope can be the sort of megaphone, so to speak, of what you're doing beyond just the specific programming?
There's so much. I mean, I think the real thing, you know, as much as we want to talk about storytelling, like, the real thing with storytelling is it's all about creating a sense of community. And like, who, like, it's about trying to figure out who that community is, you know? And so this is what I was saying about just having, for example, Instagram, to show you that the people who you reach actually maybe go way further away than you actually know. So when you talk about that, you mean like specifically for the Africa Center or just in general? I mean, because like, there's a lot of questions in there.
Maybe both. I mean, you know, what are you what do you hope is the big message that the Africa Center sends out, but then maybe more in general too, your own sort of life body of work that you're doing.
I mean, for the Africa Center, it's probably easier. And that is, I think, something that is so core to personality, which is that like Africa is incredibly fun, incredibly dynamic and incredibly complicated, but that it's not scary. And I think that's what we want to project, that like this is a place that like can show you so much about the whole world, about the universe, like if you let it. And that's what the story is we want the Africa Center to put out. Again, whether it's through exhibitions or like a policy dinner, that's what we're trying to put out, is that like all you have to do is you just have to step in and you will see a totally different world from what all the newspapers or whatever have told you. And that world is exciting. You know, and that world is dynamic, and that world will set you free. You know, personally, for me, I think it's something that we talked about at the beginning. For me, it's this intense competition between wanting the freedom to tell all kinds of stories and also feeling that like I need to do something that is like impactful and transformative in the world. And, you know, I think my life's journey is going to be about how do you, and I don't think it's, I think balance is the wrong word, but I think it's more how do you live that, those desires, which are equally strong in me. And like, how do you, you know, does one win out like over the other? I don't know. Or do they inform each other in such a way that like you can project and amplify stories and be exposed to stories and then tell stories that you didn't even think that you would see? And so that's kind of what I'm always on the lookout for, is like, what are the things that, what can I write? What can I create? What can I tell that will have both satisfy this need to be an artist, but at the same time have that profoundly socially transformative impact. And, you know, I don't know if you got ideas, tell me, because I think it is both a blessing and a struggle.
Yeah. Have you figured out your next story, your next book?
I have two ideas that are kind of spinning around, but right now it's mostly about this Africa Center. So I think, you know, you start a new project and like it necessarily consumes you until you figure you have a footing, and then you can start saying, okay, like what is the next creative thing? Mm-hmm. Also, you know, I finished Speak No Evil in 2017. It was published in 2018, and like you just need a little bit of calm time, because writing a book sucks. Like, I, you know, you always forget, like you finish it and then there's this euphoria between like handing in your final draft and publication. That's just like you're on cloud nine. It's the best thing in the world. And then you sit down to start writing again. And you're like, why does anyone do this? Yeah, like, what is the point?
Hangover or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm right now in that period where I've come out of the euphoria. I'm not quite ready to like start banging my head against the wall. So I'm just going to try and coast a little bit.
Well, Uzo, this is great. Thanks for joining us today. And
thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. You can find more episodes of the Time Sensitive Podcast on our website, timesensitive.fm, or on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv.